This is Free Speech Radio News for April 13th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, civil unrest in Cincinnati. 15 African-American men killed by police in 5 years pushes a community over the edge. Will the global warming treaty melt down? Free trade versus public schools. And
I've never seen my country. My mother is 42 right now, and she's never seen her country. It's our country, but we can't go back to it. That's not justice.
Thousands rally for the Palestinian right of return. Scores of youths took to the streets of Cincinnati this week, throwing stones, breaking windows, and assaulting motorists following Saturday's police killing of Timothy Thomas, an unarmed 19-year-old African-American man. Thomas fled after police officer Stephen Roach attempted to arrest him for failing to appear in court on misdemeanor charges and traffic violations. Roach pursued Thomas into an alley where the officer shot him dead. The officer said he feared for his life when Thomas reached toward his waist. On Monday night, following peaceful protests and a city council meeting devoted to the killing, the Over the Rhine neighborhood where Thomas was killed erupted in rioting and looting, which has continued each night through the week. In response, Cincinnati Mayor Charles Lucan has imposed a curfew in the city from 8 p.m. until 6 a.m. and says he may ask the National Guard to come into the city this weekend. Meanwhile, the FBI is investigating the Thomas killing for possible civil rights violations. And NAACP President Kwesi Mfume has come to Cincinnati to meet with local leaders. Pastor Damon Lynch III, president of Cincinnati's Black United Front, says the Cincinnati Police Department's long-standing pattern of racially motivated abuse and misconduct has fueled the outrage following the Thomas killing. Since 1995, Cincinnati police have killed 15 people, all of them African-American men. Four of those deaths have come since November, and just last month, a coalition of civil rights groups filed a class action lawsuit against the city for racial profiling.
The Cincinnati Black United Front and the ACLU filed a class action lawsuit against the city of Cincinnati and against racial profiling, and it happened right after Roger Owens' beating. Another African-American man was killed by the hands of the police while being taken into custody. Mr. Owensby was killed in what was called a chokehold gone bad. They choked the life out of him. Right after that, the community filed a class action lawsuit, but then it didn't take too long after that that Timothy Thomas was killed. And so, for the most part, the community has been docile. The African-American community has been docile, but it's just gotten to a point where the frustrations have risen to the level of just tired, can't take it anymore, and young people have hit the streets, and they're expressing their anger through the violence that we now see in our streets.
Now, Timothy Thomas was killed last Saturday, but the unrest that we've been seeing over the last few nights didn't begin until Monday.
What traditionally happens here is that when an officer kills a civilian, there's a hush, there's a silence. There's no information that comes out from the administration, and the community believes that the cover-up is being formed. Out of the 15 black men that have been killed, only two officers have ever been indicted. Those two have been indicted, but they have not been convicted. And the belief is that the officers will always walk away scot-free. So on Monday, there was a meeting at city council that the community came out and expressed their anger. And they only had one question. The mother of Timothy Thomas was there. And the question was, why was he shot? And they would not give us an answer. Cincinnati police have a pat answer. I feared for my life, no matter what the situation. And for the broader community, that seems to say, of course, the officer was justified. He was afraid. We're tired of officers in our communities policing us who are afraid of us. And if they're afraid, they feel that that's justification. Pulling the trigger is the easy way out. And it just continues to lose. We continue to lose life in our community. So after not getting an answer at community council meeting, community took it to the street. Started with a peaceful protest in front of District 1, and then violence erupted on into Wednesday night.
The press right now is talking about the violence that's been going on as racial violence, and I know that Mayor Charles Lucan has spoken out against the targeting of white citizens in Cincinnati. What can you tell us about what is it like on the ground there? Is this really something that's targeting whites?
Whites have been targeted. Whites have been pulled from their cars. Whites have been beaten. That is a tragic, those are tragic events because it's not a black-white thing. It's really just a city problem that we have. Cincinnati has some serious racial issues that we never want to address. We want to continue to pretend like we're one of the most livable cities in America, and we are not. We're a sick city that has some racial issues that need to be dealt with. And so individual rights should not be targeted. What should be targeted is a system that's broke, because the reality is if nothing changes, then nothing will change. And the police culture that we have in Cincinnati needs to change.
I know you've spoken out against violent acts and against property destruction, but do you think it's also the case that if it weren't for some of those acts, the nation would not be hearing about this case?
That is sad but true. What has happened here, as tragic as it is, the destruction of property, there have been no loss of life, but it was almost necessary. We're at number 15, and the community is saying, we're not going to wait until 16. We're tired of the empty promises. We're tired of the excuses. We're tired of seeing officers walk away scot-free. So what this violence has done is bring it to a head. It's brought out the broader community who's been quiet. The business community has been quiet from 1 through 14. The broad religious community has been quiet on 1 through 14. There have been no real changes. And now we have to, you know, use these tragic events to leverage some real systemic change in our city.
Where do you think things are going to go from here?
You will probably have more unrest. We are opening our churches. Our churches have been open for the last two nights, all night. We're opening our churches as safe houses, places of refuge and sanctuary for young people who don't heed the curfew and who find themselves out after 8 o'clock. There will be a place for them to come. And once they come inside, we are encouraging them to stay inside until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. But there are also groups of leaders who will be meeting with the young people in the next few days and meeting with the business community and the city leaders to say that there needs to be some real substantive plans of action that deal with the frustration, that deal with changing the police culture. We're looking for some resignations to happen by Monday in our city. We expect the safety director to be gone. And if not, then our protest will prayerfully not be violent, but it will be strong. We're looking at economic sanctions against our city. We're looking at the world knowing that this is not a city where you want to bring your conventions. This is not a city. This is an intolerant city. And we think until they're hit in their pockets, that real change won't take place.
On Tuesday, Los Angeles voters went to the polls to decide, among other things, who would be their next mayor. The race turned out to be the most expensive in the city's history, costing over $17.2 million. But as Fernando Velasquez reports, the record expenditures have attracted less attention than the emergence of Latino power in the city's politics.
Although Latinos make up nearly one-third of the electorate, they turn out in full force to support Antonio Villaraigosa, a former Speaker of California State Assembly. The latest vote count leave City Attorney James Hahn and Villaraigosa as the two finalists for the June 5th runoff election. Some suggest that the upcoming match will bring back the heated racial politics of Proposition 187, an anti-immigrant initiative promoted a few years back by former California Governor Pete Wilson. Villaraigosa responded to it this way.
I don't think that it has anything to do with Proposition 187. I think what it has to do with is that we focused on the issues important to people in the city. What we said was we want to live in a city where all of us are welcome, where all of us can prosper together, where all of the communities that make up Los Angeles get their fair share of services and assets. And I think that's what people responded to. A leader who said, I can bring us together. I've got a track record of accomplishment to get things done.
James Hahn, a former city controller and four-time city attorney, bombarded the electorate with television ads emphasizing that experience counts. His San Fernando Valley and Westside conservative liberal supporters are expected to join forces with African Americans next June. Many black voters supported Hahn in part for his father, Kenneth Hahn, and his close relationship with former mayor Tom Bradley. The big question is whether Republican Steve Soboroff's supporters will switch to Villaraigosa's side. Soboroff's campaigned with the problem solver, not a politician slogan, and that got him a healthy third place. But the continuous barrages of television ads and billboards could not defeat the thousands of trade union volunteers dispatched by the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor and the United Farm Workers. Gilbert Cedillo, a member of the state assembly, described Villaraigosa's success as a people's wise choice.
Today is a historic day for the city of Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles has voted for hope and promise. and for a progressive agenda for the city. The choices were very clear, and they made a clear choice to vote for Antonio Villaraigosa and this new vision and this new movement for the city of Los Angeles in the new millennium.
Villaraigosa's alliance with the unions may create difficulties in his coalition building. According to Pepe Jaques from Comité Pro Uno, the union's effort to organize the Native American-owned casinos in nearby Riverside County have already generated trouble for the charismatic Chicano. Their fear of seeing their casino employees join the union has prompted the wealthy owners to contribute to Villaraigosa's adversaries' campaign, says Jaques. For State Senator Gloria Romero, Villaraigosa is the hope for tomorrow's Angelinos. He is proud to be a Latino, but that doesn't stop him from being a progressive with politics of inclusion, she says.
I think he can make a significant difference, but I think he makes the difference not just in that he's a Latino. To me, I always take a look at what is the class basis of the campaign that he ran on. We've had Latinos run for office before, and the fire hasn't been generated. I think Antonio's message was less about him being a Latino than him about understanding what it takes to have an agenda that brings about progressive change for this community. So, to me, when I look at Antonio, I'm proud that he's Latino. I'm proud that he's a Chicano Mexican American. But I am more proud that his progress, that his ideals, that his politics, his values, that's what moves and builds a coalition for progressive change. I'm excited that he's a Latino, but I am more honored to stand with him because of the principles that he espouses. Antonio's message is one of inclusion, not exclusion.
No one doubts Los Angeles is changing. Not only the demographics, but the old powerhouse as well. In Tuesday's election, Republican Steve Soboroff had a very strong support from the current mayor, but that wasn't enough to stop the multiracial coalition of Villaraigosa's forces, marching with the United Farm Workers' rallying cry, "Si se puede," it can be done. For Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles, this is Fernando Velasquez.
Canada's Quebec City is bracing itself to host the Summit of the Americas from April 20th to the 22nd. The summit will bring 34 heads of state and over 9,000 delegates to the city for the third in a series of meetings aimed at uniting the economies of the Western Hemisphere. The agreement to be negotiated in Quebec City is the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. The draft of the official agreement has not yet been made public, and opponents say the heads of state are keeping it secret because if its contents were known, it would lead to even more opposition. Prior to the official summit meeting on April 17th and 18th, a parallel forum will be conducted by opponents of the official summit. The People's Summit will include teach-ins, concerts, demonstrations, and public forums. The largest such forum, with 250 delegates from the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and Central and South America, is one being organized to discuss how to preserve quality public education in the face of a global push for privatization, which has already affected vital public goods, from healthcare to water supplies. From Montreal, Stephen Cooperman reports on why education has become such an important issue for opponents of the FTAA.
It's lunchtime, time to take a break from class. They've just spent the morning learning some key lessons. But for opponents of the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the lessons they could soon be learning might be geared specifically to the benefit of multinational for-profit educational service providers. Critics say the trade agreement would make the children mere consumers in training in an ominous privatized education system, public education a mere relic of the past. And the reason for the fears is the suspicion the FTAA would build on previous trade agreements that have liberalized the global trade in services, trade agreements where education is included in the definition of services. And like its predecessor NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the FTAA would give multinational corporations sweeping new powers to compete with and challenge governments in providing services. Marilise Reddick is a secondary school teacher and president of the Canadian Teachers Federation, which represents 240,000 elementary and secondary school teachers across Canada.
It's a fundamental shift in terms of why we're providing education. And corporations want to get education into a trade agreement because they know there are billions of dollars to be made. And it moves it from the responsibility of state and society to provide it for all children to a market-driven service where the bottom line is maximizing opportunities for profits for these corporations.
And with global expenditures on education exceeding $3 trillion a year, there's much profit indeed to be made. In Canada, opponents of including education in the pact fear mostly American for-profit educational service providers who would have enshrined rights to challenge the government's monopoly in providing education. As in the case of Educational Alternatives Incorporated, which took over public schools in Hartford and Baltimore, and notably also had their contracts canceled. Canceled due to complaints ranging from how they deal with children with learning disabilities, how they engage in union busting, and how they formulate standardized curriculum and testing packages. Critics say if the FTAA is passed, national governments will no longer be able to guarantee standards of education for fear of legal reprisals from corporations accusing it of setting up barriers to competition. According to Reddick, the impact of scenarios like this on course content are daunting as well. She uses the example of a history course.
If it's a course that is designed for Canadian students in Quebec, Montreal students, that course will look very different than if it's designed by a university or a corporation based out of Texas. I mean, think of the subject matter and the content, the recognition of our Canadian history and our culture and our orientation. What a vast difference in terms of it being designed by people in Montreal, teachers and educators in Montreal, and a corporation down in Texas.
Reddick's sentiments are echoed by others who oppose designating education as a service under any trade agreement. People such as David Bernance. He's a researcher for the Student Union at Concordia University in Montreal. He also wrote a book about privatizing education. Bernance says any trade deal, including education, would also strike a severe blow to Canadian cultural sovereignty.
The Canadian education system is more vulnerable just to the extent that there's a lot more public education that exists here and a lot less private. So it's a market that a lot of corporations, specifically American multinational corporations that do business, that are education service providers, I think that they're looking to Canada as a way to expand, and you know, it's just another form of American cultural imperialism moving into Canada.
An example of a type of organization that has Bernance fearing for Canada's cultural sovereignty is the University of Phoenix. It's a for-profit online university originating in the United States. And under an expanded NAFTA-type trade agreement, a for-profit organization could compete with a public organization for public funding, and governments are prohibited from giving preferential funding. For Bernance, the thought is unappealing at best.
Phoenix University is totally, it's driven by profit. For profit, that's what its interest is. It's not an interest in public education and educating critically thinking citizens. So if that's what's driving it, then it's potentially very dangerous.
For now, American for-profit education corporations do not receive Canadian public funding. But the fear continues to exist that all of this could change were the FTAA to be enacted. And so while the outcome of this pact is being decided behind the barricaded walls of Quebec City, opponents of a trade pact that included education are preparing a joint declaration to present to the heads of state, a declaration guaranteeing the protection of public education. And it remains to be seen whether or not they'll be successful up against the powerful multinational corporations. So like environmental and human rights issues, education is one of many high-stakes issues to be decided in the pivotal meetings in Quebec City. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Stephen Cooperman in Montreal, Canada.
George W. Bush's first budget as president was released this week, and it included cuts in funding for research into energy conservation. The conservation cuts will likely add to the disappointment and frustration of international governments set off by the Bush administration's declaration 2 weeks ago that it would withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol on greenhouse gases. Although the survival of the treaty, if not the climate, is in question, the European Union is now facing an opportunity to show its commitment and leadership. While some say that the European Commission and its president, Romano Prodi, have reached their hour of reckoning, the real question the world must face is whether the Kyoto Treaty is already dead. From London, Patrick Beckett reports.
President George W. Bush, polluter of the free world, read the banner headline of Britain's Telegraph newspaper on March 30th. Environmental groups and politicians across Europe expressed dismay at the Bush administration's surprise announcement, which contradicts years of commitments made by the United States towards climate protection. The reaction to this abrupt change in U.S. policy has not diminished in the past 2 weeks. From grassroots campaign to the policymaking level, efforts are being aimed at two fronts, either bringing the U.S. back to the table or moving forward to ratify the Kyoto Protocol without them. France's President Chirac German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and Britain's Labour government are among those concerned that the world's largest producer of carbon emissions has forsaken the treaty. Nigel Griffiths is a Labour Minister of Parliament.
Prime Minister Tony Blair has been deeply shocked at the change of policy in America, and I know will be making his own representations to the American administration.
Griffiths and more than 60 other members of British Parliament this week launched an email campaign to the president of the Coca-Cola Company, hoping that this U.S. corporation will use its lobbying interests to influence the White House.
The Coca-Cola Company gave substantial donations to the Republicans last year, and therefore they do have a friend in the White House. And this campaign is designed to get the president's friends to change the president's mind.
Environmental groups are taking similar actions. Greenpeace International mailed letters to the top 100 U.S. Fortune 500 companies requesting they make their positions clear on the Kyoto Treaty and President Bush's actions. Bill Hare is Greenpeace International's climate policy director.
We really believe that whilst American people have the right to vote in an election, the rest of us don't, and people want to express their feelings via the marketplace.
The European Union has acted quickly to maintain support for the treaty at the international level, having supported even stronger climate protection commitments than outlined in the Kyoto Accord. There is a sense of urgency to their actions. Furthermore, it is seen as an opportunity to pass Brussels' own credibility test as a unified European leader. Again, Bill Hare of Greenpeace.
Well, I think the signals we've got from the member states of the European Union are fairly strong, and that is that the Union intends to proceed without the United States if necessary.
A delegation of environmental ministers from the European Commission returned Wednesday from a whistle-stop trip to Canada, Russia, Iran, Japan, and China, key players in climate negotiations. The Commission has indicated that all countries visited expressed serious concerns about recent scientific evidence of climate change and on the new U.S. position on the Kyoto Protocol. Further talks are expected at a meeting in New York, April 21st. Bo Jelen is the chief negotiator for climate issues for Sweden, which currently holds the presidency of the European Union. Jelen chaired the International Negotiating Committee, which over the years managed to forge the agreements which make up the Kyoto Protocol.
The important thing now is that we keep the process moving. Our main concern with regard to the stance taken by the United States new administration, which was, as you know, quite unexpected, because we had got the impression at Trieste, for instance, that they were much more flexible. What is our concern is really that a major negotiating effort in a multilateral framework has been questioned.
It remains to be seen how the U.S. will respond to the growing international criticism. It is likely that Washington's actions will have a significant effect on U.S.-European relations. Christian Vrolik is with the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London.
So this is going to be a full part of all the trade negotiations and trade relations between the U.S. and Europe. We're not only going to talk about bananas or tuna anymore. We're now going to talk about climate change and climate-friendly products and emissions as well.
The European commitment to the Kyoto policy is strong, and it is unlikely that Washington will receive support for anything less than full commitment. Again, Bo Jelen.
We speak to the line that there are no other solutions beyond the Kyoto Protocol. The Kyoto Protocol is, in fact, not just the protocol. It is part and parcel of the whole negotiating effort that began with the climate convention that, of course, has been ratified by the United States already in 1992.
A new report out from the U.S. Department of Energy predicts that without a global warming treaty, carbon dioxide emissions will double worldwide by the year 2020. A United Nations agency says if that happens, farmers can expect more flooding, desertification, and drought. Climate changes that the UN says could have a devastating effect on the world's food supply. Friends of the Earth International has aimed a campaign at the White House, with over 50,000 supporters emailing their request that the president changes his mind. The White House server has reportedly crashed twice under the heavy flood of critical emails. This is Patrick Beckett, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Israel escalated its attacks against Palestinians in the occupied territories to a new level this week, as ground troops entered the town of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip and bulldozed 35 houses, leaving at least 200 Palestinians homeless. Israel justified the bulldozings as a security measure against recent gunfire on Israeli soldiers. But to Palestinians, the house demolitions were the same kind of collective punishment Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has inflicted on Palestinians throughout his military and political career. Some of those whose homes were bulldozed were driven from Palestine in 1948, when hundreds of thousands of Arab inhabitants were displaced after the proclamation of the State of Israel. Many were expelled, and others fled in fear, as armed Jewish settlers occupied their towns and villages. Today, there are almost 5 million Palestinian refugees. One-fifth of them are living in camps in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, like the camp in Khan Yunis, and in neighboring states. Their fate remains in the hands of the Israeli government, which refuses to allow them to return, although the United Nations has repeatedly affirmed their right to do so. At one of dozens of demonstrations around the world, thousands of protesters rallied in support of the Palestinian right to return outside the Israeli mission to the United Nations in New York. Susan Wood was there and files this report.
The march and rally were planned as a commemoration of a massacre that took place on April 9, 1948. On that date, Jewish paramilitary forces allegedly slaughtered men, women, and children in the Palestinian Arab village of Deir Yassin, 3 miles west of Jerusalem. While the atrocities were documented by international observers, the Israeli government and its U.S. supporters continue to deny that they took place. Abbas Hamida, a spokesperson for Al-Auda, is a young Palestinian whose late father was a survivor of Deir Yassin. Speaking at the Union Square rally, he called on Israel to withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, territories it occupied after the 1967 war. And he insisted the Palestinians' right of return must not be contingent on an eventual peace deal between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority.
Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine has created the largest and longest refugee group at the present time in history. UN Resolution 194 states that the Palestinians have the right to return to their homes and villages, not simply what may be designated as a Palestinian national state. Therefore, I want to fulfill my father's dream and the Palestinian people's dream and return to Palestine.
Many demonstrators expressed support for the current uprising in the occupied territories and hostility towards the Israeli government, whose troops have killed 440 Palestinians since last September, 33% of them aged 18 or under. Author and educator Dr. Edward Said pointed out that Israel's policies are abhorrent to people around the world, including many Israeli and American Jews.
There's an increasing number of Israeli Jews and American Jews and non-Jews who are sick to death of this posture that claims, that the Israelis claim, that they represent the Jewish people. There's a group, for example, of Israelis who are trying to stop the house demolitions that are going on even as we speak. People's houses are being bulldozed out of existence by Israelis, by Israeli soldiers. But there are Israelis joining with Palestinians in peaceful, non-violent, but massive organized resistance, which is the only thing that's going to bring this occupation to an end.
Said called for an end to U.S. support of Israel.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood in New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on 4 continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters have put their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Jade Padgett-Seekins is the technical producer. Thanks to Vanessa Tate for technical assistance. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.